Good evening. Welcome to our talk this evening. Lincoln's leadership and communication style has been the subject of much study over the years. In our last lecture, we heard how Lincoln was somewhat lost during the crisis of secession. However, over time, he developed into an effective and often imitated leader. Tonight, we will learn about the type of leader and communicator that Lincoln became. Tonight's lecture is part of the traveling exhibition, Lincoln, the Constitution, and the Civil War, which, if you have not already viewed, I invite you to look at after the lecture. This exhibition was sponsored by the National Constitution Center, the American Library Association, and funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and here on this campus, sponsored by WKU Libraries, Department of Library, Special Collections, and Kentucky Museum. Tonight, we're privileged to have Dr. Cecile Garman. She has many years of experience in both the fields of leadership and communication. She has a PhD from Vanderbilt University in Educational Philosophy and Intercultural Education Policy, and a certificate from the Harvard University Institute of Educational Management. Dr. Garman is director of the Leadership Studies Program and professor of communication here at WKU. She's an internationally recognized expert and a frequent speaker at professional conferences in both the fields of leadership and communication. Dr. Garman.
Thank you, Brian, for those nice words. I appreciate that. I think you exaggerated a good bit, but I'm glad to hear it. It was nice to hear anyway. I'm glad to see you all here tonight, and I'm glad I feel so pleased to have been invited to speak on this subject. I am not an authority on Lincoln, but I do study leadership, and I do study communication and rhetoric, and to put those together and to talk about the Gettysburg Address is about the best thing you can do. I can't think of any better thing to do. A little bit of short speech like that is so powerful, and to put those two items together is really exciting. So I'm glad to be here and glad to have the opportunity to talk with you. What I'd like to do tonight is to provide a short background about the speech. I won't go into the Civil War and talk all about that, but just a few things about Gettysburg itself, and then talk about some of the communication aspects of the speech, and then move on to the rhetorical elements, and finally talk a little bit about leadership. And when we get to the rhetorical elements, Brian has kindly given you all a copy of it, and I want you to help me identify the rhetorical elements that they appear in the speech. So I won't call you out individually, but I want you to look at it. I won't be like in class when I'm saying, okay, now it's your turn to answer, but let's do kind of work together on it. And then finally, I'll talk about leadership and look at some of the characteristics of leadership that appear in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. First, let's take a look at the environment. Think about this town. And you think about your hometown. I'm from Glasgow, and Glasgow might be a little bit larger than Gettysburg was at that time, but it was a market town in an agricultural area. And for 3 days in July of 1863, one of the most violent battles in American history took place there. Can you imagine in your hometown what it would be like in a small market town to have this huge army with 35,000 casualties? Now that's including dead, wounded, and prisoners, but 35,000 casualties in that town, and then the armies move off, and what have you got left? What is your life like then? What is your culture and your town like? One of the problems that they had was that the armies had to move out so fast they didn't have time to adequately bury the dead. So when Lincoln and the group came there in November of that same year, 4.5 months later, there were still people who weren't buried, or maybe partially buried. Of course, the farmers had started plowing again, and they were turning up bodies and parts of bodies. This is a gruesome picture, but it was a gruesome time. It was a very gruesome picture of a time for somebody to come and dedicate something. Apparently, the story of how this got started is kind of interesting. Herbert Carson, who is Brian's father, by the way, has given us a very interesting detail of the committee's work to develop this dedicatory event. And at that time, they decided that they wanted to dedicate the battlefield and to the dead. And at that time, rhetoric and long speeches was a favored pastime for people to get together and do that. They didn't have television and they didn't have Facebook and all the other things that we had today to entertain them. So they were interested in listening to long orations, very classical orations. And they invited Edward Everett, who was a former senator, a former representative, a former governor, and was the president of Harvard, to come. He was one of the best-known orators of the time. And they invited him to come and give the oration, which he did for 2 hours. They also sent out invitations to other people. And because Lincoln apparently didn't accept many invitations for public speaking at that time, apparently he had some other things to think about during that period of time, but he agreed to come. And then they were so shocked they didn't know exactly what to do. So they asked him to make a few appropriate remarks, which is what he did, made a few appropriate remarks. So let's talk a little about this. The Gettysburg Address has endured as one of the most beloved speeches in American history. Some people say that it is the most beloved speech in the history of the world. That's an exaggeration, I guess, and I'm not sure that I've ever seen any quantifiable data that says that. I'm not sure how you gather quantifiable data. But no matter whether it's true or not, the question remains, what is it about this speech that makes it so meaningful? And why have the words endured so long after the time of their delivery? We understand that Gettysburg was one of the most decisive battles of the war and cost about 53,000 casualties. Attending and listening to public speeches was a tradition of the people at that time, and that's why they invited Edward Everett, who was such a well-known orator. Lincoln, who had 4.5 months to prepare his remarks, was only invited a few weeks before. So they asked him to give a few appropriate remarks. Now, there are a lot of legends about when and how Lincoln developed his speech. One of the most common ones is that he wrote it on the back of an envelope on his way to Gettysburg. But that doesn't appear to be true. I'm sorry to disillusion you. That doesn't seem to be the case. It seems that most scholars think that he had studied his subject and written out his thoughts, if not the whole first draft by the time he left Washington. He actually had plenty of time to think about Gettysburg, and of course this was very much on his mind. And so since he didn't accept many public invitations to speak, he had time to develop this. And to think about this as a time for him to share his ideas about the rebirth of the country and the rebirth of liberty and freedom for all. What Lincoln did not say is very interesting, particularly when you compare it. I haven't read Mr. Everett's speech, but the 2-hour speech he gave, when you compare the tone of those two, it's very different. He didn't say Gettysburg. He didn't say Confederate. He didn't say battle. He didn't say South or cemetery or Union. He used none of those. In fact, he didn't refer to the battle at all. He didn't call the names of any generals, soldiers. He didn't talk about slavery. None of those things. Made no specific reference to the battle. Instead, he spoke in a very abstract tone of delivering an angry diatribe like Everett had, he emphasized healing. And he emphasized working toward the ideals set out in the Declaration of Independence. Now, he used only 267 words and 10 sentences. Some of your students, I'm sure, wish your teachers would follow that same example. 250 words in class and 10 sentences would probably make you all feel a lot better. Lincoln used the first person many times, but never in the singular. He always used it in the plural. He never said I. It was always we. So the speaker, in effect, is American and the Unionist, but not the president. Let's talk a little bit about the structure. You can look at your copy of it there. It has a three-part structure, and this is clear here. It's that the three-part structure clearly underscores the meaning of Lincoln's address. The first part, 4 score and 7 years ago and so forth, is about the past. If you look at that, it talks about the past, about the founding of the nation, and it's a brief summation of history. The next 6 sentences that begin, now we're engaging the Great Civil War, a focus on the sacrifice of the soldiers in the battlefield, the contemporary time. So he's talked about the past and the present. And then the final 3 sentences down here that begin with, it's weather for us and so forth, talk about the future and the task that lies ahead in order for the country to realize the aspirations and the ideals of the founders. These are the things that the present must choose in order to bring about the future cause of democracy. It also has a kind of an hourglass shape. It begins on a general note, then it progressively focuses on specific occasions, and then it goes outward again to general and universal concerns. Finally, I would mention to you that the text repeats the word dedicate 6 times, and its meaning shifts through 3 different meanings. Each sense of this is repeated twice. In the past part, in the section on the past, Lincoln explains that the nation was dedicated to liberty and equality. And the question is now whether a nation that's so dedicated can survive. Here, dedicate means to set apart for a special purpose. So there's one meaning of dedicate, to set apart for a special purpose. As the president, Lincoln explains, those attending the service are gathered to dedicate a portion of the battlefield. And in this case, dedicate means to hallow or to consecrate. That is, to set aside for a deity or for religious purposes. And then finally, as he turns toward the future, Lincoln asks the audience to dedicate itself to the unfinished work and to the great task remaining before. In this sentence, dedicate means to commit oneself to a particular course of action. So you see he uses the same verb there, repeats each one of them, at least once, but he uses them with different meanings. So you have contrasting ideas. It shows the great mastery he had of the language. Lincoln started in the past by placing the battlefield at Gettysburg and the insignificance of the dedication ceremony in the context of American history. His opening words highlighted historical continuity, 4 score and 7 years, continuity. His biblical allusion accented permanence. We should keep in mind that the Bible was not merely seen as an unassailable document, but the wisdom of God and God's chosen people passed on to believers, which was a concept most Americans accepted without question. And note also that the continuity of the United States has surpassed the biblical time frame of life and death, in turn making the United States and its Constitution a sacred document ordained by God as a part of his divine plan for both Americans specifically and humanity in general. In speaking of our fathers, Lincoln invoked the common heritage of the Founding Fathers for both Northerners and Southerners. At the same time, he identified himself not with the leaders of the American people, but with the audience, as children of their great experiment in liberty and equality. the trajectory of the crucial first sentence underscores the timeless American truth that all men are created equal, which, although it had been controversial among the landed leaders of the Republic in 1776, had been accepted as a common fact by the 1860s. And Lincoln, in this sentence, reaffirmed that the war was about both liberty and union. Let's look at the first sentence. 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. This sentence sets the time and the place to establish the scene, which directly references the Declaration of Independence, which is considered a sacred document by both the Union and the Secessionists. It refers to the Declaration's statement, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." He repeats that. Poetically, the line begins with two rhyming words, fourscore, and it sets a rhythmic tone to the whole thing. The line also contains the rhythm of alliteration, fathers, fourth, the new nation. We'll talk more about alliteration in a minute. The biblical ring of his opening words is rooted in Psalm 90. The days of our years are 70, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, and so forth. See, he's talking, using the biblical reference there. Now, interestingly enough, 70 was not a simple way to say 87. Most of us today would say 87. Or as many, we make them decorated up a little bit. But 70, by using that, Lincoln was asking his audience to calculate backward. He was putting them to work, asking them to calculate backward to discover that the nation's starting point was not the Constitution or the inauguration of Washington, but was the Declaration of Independence in 1776. Plus 70 back from 1863 to 1776. Scores, that is 20-year periods, are also a shorthand way of measuring generations. And this is another aspect that's interesting. While if he had stated that 87 years would have sounded like a long time to people whose life expectancy was about 60 years, Lincoln's reference shows only that a short time in human years had passed. Assuming that most people became parents in their early 20s or in their 20s, a 40-year-old listener or reader could have a grandparent who had lived at the time of the Declaration, which would be a relatively short time in which to create a new nation based on this remarkable social experiment in liberty and equality. I think for us today, it's hard for us to imagine what an innovative idea it was to have a social system based on liberty and equality. It was such a novel idea, so different. And in 1776, when our forefathers did that, and then it didn't work, or it didn't stop the schism that tried to take place. And Lincoln is trying to bring back a rebirth, and trying to get it back to him. The shortness of time also points out the fragility of the nation. Let's go on to the second paragraph. Now we're engaged in the Great Civil War, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. Now, this speech is an epidictic, or ceremonial speech. Also, it's a funerary, and a funerary oration has a long-standing tradition. They date back to ancient Greece. One of the best known is Pericles' funeral oration, spoken in 410 BC during the Peloponnesian War. Also, battlefield dedications have long been visited by leaders throughout history. And Lincoln's statement that he, as the nation's leader, should perform this duty was an accepted fact among the politicians of the day. The unusual nature of this specific dedication was that it was happening during active wartime, and that the battle had happened so recently, and the evidence of it was all around them. So Lincoln also establishes a justification for the audience to be at the event. While succeeding sentence immediately contradicts its importance by saying that the emphasis on the dead. So you see, he says it's important, it's appropriate that we be here, but it really doesn't make any difference because what really is important is what they did here. Okay, in the final part, he says the world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And it's similar to what you are going down the rest. In the last three sentences of the address, then Lincoln shifts his focus for the final time. He's moved to the future. He's recalled the past and what the nation did at its beginning. He has recited what the soldiers did in the present, and now he's prepared to open up to the future and speak to the responsibility of the audience for the future. He trivializes his own importance while again adding to the emphasis of the dead. He also speaks in the plural, which places his identity among the audience, not as the leader or the speaker of the event. Lincoln pointed away from words to deeds. He moved from saying the importance of words, and he says, oh, it doesn't matter what we say here, it's what they did here. So he moves from words to deeds. He, the master of words, says that's not important, it's the actions that matter. His subtle point is that the dead gave all they had. They couldn't do any more. And now the emphasis shifts to what is responsibility of the audience and what the audience has to do to continue the struggle. And Lincoln argues that that's the true way to honor the sacrifice of the dead. While it's not clear that Lincoln actually used the words under God in his speech, because they think it may have been added later when people asked for copies of the speech. Nevertheless, the line continues the theme of past and future. Whether he actually said it that day or not, including it in there, continues that line of past and future. Lincoln clearly felt that the United States and its special place as the birth of democracy had both religious as well as political importance. He consistently invoked God in most of his major speeches, for instance. In the first years of the Civil War, Lincoln found himself wrestling in new ways with the purposes of God in history. The death of so many soldiers brought him face to face with considering the meaning of life. A new birth of freedom was also laced with political and religious definitions. First, it contrasts the new with the old. The new birth, which emerged in the context of war and Lincoln's leadership then at Gettysburg, said that he was no longer defending the old Union, like he did in his first inaugural address in 1861. Now with the country at war, it was pointless to try to maintain that dichotomy. So instead, he was declaring that the new Union would start and that it would fulfill the Jeffersonian promise of liberty for all, which was the crucial step that they had, the founding fathers had been afraid to take in 1776. Think about this in terms of Christianity, too. The new birth in Christianity and in evangelical movements is a spiritual birth made by the choice of the believer. In essence, through the horrors of war, the United States is born again as it should have been born originally. The new birth was a paradox in both politics and religion. Lincoln and scholars since then had come to see the Civil War as a ritual of purification. The old Union had to die just as old men had to die. In death, there was preparation for a new Union and a new humanity. The last 10 words of the address form an if-then conditional sentence. If we honor the dead here by fighting to preserve the Union at all costs, like they did, and ensure liberty for all, our experiment, democracy, will be born again in the way it should have been, without slavery, and it will never die. Notice that in his life he uses a negative in the last line. And I think that's deliberate. The scholars think it was not an accident that he said, shall not perish. He didn't say shall continue, he said shall not perish. Because it demonstrates the threat of annihilation if they fail. Lincoln was putting the fate of the war in his listeners' hands. They weren't putting down a small rebellion that could have been won or lost with little consequence. They were fighting for their very survival. In peacetime, Lincoln could have said, we'll live forever, or flourish for all time. But the struggle of the war put the importance on victory, and the shall not perish implied that the nation was potentially on its deathbed. Okay, so that's the speech. Let's talk about rhetoric now. Let's talk about the rhetorical devices. Rhetoric is understood as the ability to move an audience to deep emotion and to action. And it can be among a leader's most effective tools or resources. Because leaders move others to follow them, the ability to persuade or to move people, to convince them that one has the right answer and will direct them wisely, is a very valuable tool. Lincoln employed many rhetorical devices in his talent with words, but his mature speeches are especially characterized by grammatical parallelism, antithesis, alliteration, and repetition. In the Gettysburg Address, he also employed the extended metaphor, which gave much power to his speech. What I'd like for us to do now is talk a little bit about these, and you all look at them and find them for me, okay? And there's no failing. I won't take grades or anything like that. And you don't have to stay after school if you can't find one. But let's do this. Let's talk about parallelism. Parallel structures are structures that are grammatically similar. Some of you all may be a little bit weak on remembering exactly that, but some of us who steal great papers all the time, parallel structures all the time, look like a parallel structure. A parallel structure is one that is grouped together. There are at least two that are grammatically the same, like prepositional phrases or subordinate clauses or independent clauses. A prepositional phrase and an independent clause are not parallel. So you see what I'm saying? So let me give you an example of one to start with. Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition, in the very first line. Conceived is a past participle with a prepositional phrase after. Dedicated is a past participle with a prepositional phrase after. So it's a parallel structure. Parallel structures are important devices in speeches. So give me some examples of some others. Can y'all find them in there? Don't be afraid to speak out. I'm sure you've got them. I'm sure you all have found them. Give me another example of a parallel structure.
Not Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about leadership a little bit and leadership style. In Lincoln's day, if anybody had talked about a leadership theory or a leadership model, I guess they would have thought about the great man theory. Because until fairly recently, people thought that leaders were born, that they were not made. You were either born a leader or you weren't born a leader. And there wasn't much you could do about it. One way or the other, there wasn't much you could do except fail if you tried. And unfortunately, most people, I mean, there are many people who are still alive who still think that. But in the last 40 or 50 years, researchers who were interested in leadership characteristics have learned that leadership skills are learned skills. Some people have more affinity for them than others, like some people play golf better than other people naturally. But they're skills that can be learned. And so for the last 20 years or so, people have been, researchers have been in the practice of looking at leadership skills. And they have come up with many models and many definitions of leadership. Among the literature, we find both philosophical and theoretical ideas about leadership, as well as applied models. If you look in the bookstores at Barnes & Noble and in the business books, you see lots of books on leadership. Tell you how to lead a business. This is the final way you need to lead a business. This is the newest trend in leading a business. So the business literature is full of them. But there are other models, too. Contemporary leadership theory comes mostly from Western research, mostly from the United States, as a matter of fact. But as we get more global, the leadership models will change and they will move in broader ways. We'll learn more about other cultural leadership models, and we'll begin to adapt them and compare them because leadership models follow culture. They are only effective in the culture in which they fit. So two of the most prominent categories of leadership that we talk about today are transactional and transformational. Transactional leadership is a older model in which it literally is a transaction. The leader and the follower do a transaction. An example of that might be a politician. A politician wants you to vote for him, and he says, if you'll vote for me, I'll do X things, I'll bring about X services. The voter wants X services brought about, so they vote for him. So that's it literally is a transaction. A more common model for some of us is an employment. The employer says, if you will do this service, I'll pay you this amount of money. And you say, okay, I want that amount of money, so I'll do that service and follow your leadership. Western Kentucky University says to me, if you will do these things, teach these courses, et cetera, then we'll pay you X amount of money. And I say, okay, I'm happy to do that, and I'll follow your leadership at the university because I want to sell my services for that. So it's a transaction. Now, transformational leadership is a newer idea. And it's a concept in where the leader not only understands vision and the needs of the people, but the leader also incorporates these into leading the people forward and in helping the followers develop their own leadership skills and assume some of the leadership. And this is a much more modern concept of leadership than the old transactional idea. If we look at Lincoln's ideas of leadership and the best way to tell from this is to see how he employs them in this speech. Now, Cohen has suggested that the following characteristics are appropriate to leadership: passion and proportion, empathy and detachment, courage and moderation, vision, and cognitive complexity. Lincoln has been identified as a leader who became better and stronger in high office, as Brian said a few minutes ago, because of his tremendous capacity for growth. Have you thought about that? To be at his age when he became president, I don't know how old he was, but we won 18-9 one day and he became president in 61 or something. So anyway, he was that old. But think about his tremendous capacity for growth at that point in his life. I think that's very exciting. Elihu Root credits Lincoln with three qualities of the highest order. First, his genuine appreciative sympathy for all his fellow men, for all of them. The second, a sense of proportion, which Root says is also associated with humor or a sense of humor. And the third quality was his subordination of himself to his cause. Now, there are a lot of varieties of transformational leadership in literature, but let's look at some of them in the Gettysburg Address. In order to identify Lincoln as a transformational leader, as demonstrated by his speech, we want to find that he includes some or all of the following characteristics: having and sharing a vision is one of them, showing how to carry out the vision is another one, challenging the status quo, enabling and encouraging others to join in the leadership, and then often illustrating some elements of charisma. Let's talk about visioning. I think we've already said enough, but Lincoln envisioned a new birth of freedom with a new union and exhibiting a new freedom and equality. He carried forth the vision of what the founding fathers had wanted to do but could not do, and he brought it to a new vision. And he shared this vision in terms that are deceptively simple. His short, clear speech included that vision in a very complex and powerful devices that were acceptable to the people he spoke to. Let's talk about taking on the role of leading the move toward the vision. Lincoln displayed the sense of tragedy and sorrow and the concern for the sacrifice of the soldiers, personal dedication to the task, and willingness to lead others through the difficulties that he knew they were facing. Challenging the status quo. He clearly rejected the common practice of denigrating the opposition, in this case the Southerners, whom he wished to encourage to return peacefully to the Union. Rather than pushing them aside, he wanted to bring them back in peacefully. Edward had spent his 2 hours decrying the South, the Confederacy, but Lincoln didn't mention them at all. In fact, he challenged the people to look forward to rebuilding and to enhancing the general intentions of the Founding Fathers. I'm watching the clock. Okay, enabling others. Lincoln never spoke of I, he spoke of we. And he included himself in the audience with the action more active than in the ideal. In fact, he took the position, it is rather for us the living, not for me to lead you, but for us the living to do so and so. He assumed the role of leader, but he incorporated himself in the middle of it. Colhane states that Lincoln worked collaboratively, encouraging broad discussion in his leadership groups and acknowledging the contributions of each participant. Notwithstanding the tensions of his cabinet, Lincoln was quick to praise his officers, giving them ample credit, and often took blame for their mistakes, even if he didn't cause them. The last characteristic I'll talk about is charisma, and it's probably the most dangerous. Charisma is rather nebulous, and it's not always a positive element of leadership. We can all think of some leaders we know who have been very charismatic but led people in very negative directions. So we have to think about charisma as a characteristic that fits the environment and the society in which people live. So we carry those characteristics. Lincoln was able to demonstrate levels of charisma through various functions. And because they're so contextual, it's difficult for us to identify them because we don't live in that context anymore. But Lincoln used many devices that appealed to his audience, including his great storytelling ability. He was very well known for telling stories, and that was a highly prized skill in his day. We've already talked about his oratorical skill, and I don't think we need to go on to that. Family. It seems clear that this best-loved American speech carries almost unfathomable depth of content and style. It also demonstrates the quality of leadership skills that Lincoln held, along with his rhetorical ability. His reticence about himself was preparatory to his becoming an ultimate voice. His discourses simply do not permit us to engage them in the same way that we engage more conventional discourse. They compel a reconstitution of our characters as auditors. They compel us to reconstitute ourselves as listeners to him. We are forced to a different perspective, not only from the subjects of the discourse, but also from the transparency of the discourses. Their capacity to merge subject and not to claim our attention independent of the subject. An ultimate voice is one that has attached transparency. What it says is so lightly said that we're conscious only of what it said and not of the same. While they were crafted to meet the immediate contingencies of the Civil War, Lincoln's writings continue to be read and to affect the nation's sense of itself and its history. Here we are, 150 years later, still looking at these 267 words. I believe we can return to Winston Churchill's epitaph in the Gettysburg Address, the ultimate expression of the majesty of Shakespeare's language. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have some questions?
The version that we see now, do we know that was the final version, or the earlier version?
Actually, they had at least five versions. The first two, they think, were written before he came to Gettysburg. They think he probably spoke from the second version. The last three, and frankly, I'm not sure which one we had. The last three are ones that people who asked for his speech later, they were provided, and they think that's when Under God might have been added to it.
May I speak to that
one? I wish you would.
The idea that he added later seems to be absurd in view of the fact that there were at least maybe half a dozen court reporter type people there, reporters for New York newspapers, Chicago newspapers, etc. All of them, without any collusion, without any opportunity to be together, sent by wire to their respective newspapers the speech. And every one of them had.
Okay.
And in addition to that, Lincoln had the rest of the short rest of his life to have denied that he was sent there. But it was not a question at that period of time to the degree it is now. And now it's only a relatively recent thing.
That's interesting. You know, the responses to the press at that time varied. Some of them were probably not maybe what you would get, like you would expect. One press that I read, it was, I can't remember what it was, said that and wasted their time with this little trivial speech after this glorious thing that Edward Everett had done. That's funny that it's so amazing that Edward then wrote him a note and said, I wish I could think that I had done half as well as you in my 2 hours as you did in the 2 minutes or so. So Edward knew it.
I remember reading years ago,
one of the states that even though the Douglas and Houston, that he's your student.